Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 5th of March, these are our main stories. Stringent measures to tackle the coronavirus in Italy as all schools and universities close until mid-March. The billionaire businessman Michael Bloomberg pulls out of the US presidential race, and the Brazilian president Jair Bolsonaro shocks press by sending a comedian to replace him at a briefing. Also in this podcast...
The water here is extraordinarily cold. It's just about the coldest water on Earth.
How the coldest places in the world are feeling the effects of global warming, and a step forwards for gay rights in Hong Kong. As Italy struggles to get to grips with the coronavirus, it's announced it's shutting all schools and universities until the middle of the month. The government is also closing all cinemas and theatres and is encouraging Italians not to kiss when they greet each other. 11 towns are now in lockdown, cordoned off by police roadblocks. Our correspondent in Milan, Bethany Bell, has been following developments.
This comes after a day of considerations, discussions by the cabinet here, as well as the day that we get the latest figures for people testing positive for the coronavirus in Italy has jumped to over 3,000 now, and over 100 people are known to have died.
So the Italian government is obviously taking it incredibly seriously and is taking measures. But why is Italy finding it so hard to deal with the coronavirus?
There are some people who suggest that this may have been there unrecognised, that people didn't catch it early enough. But certainly there are some people who are very critical of what the government has done, saying that they really didn't react quickly enough. Other people are saying, you know, this is a virus which is, they were caught on the hop, as it were, so very hard to try and control this. Other people say that one reason there are so many people testing positive here in Italy is that the Italians have tested so many people, and they're discovering people, many of the people they have tested for this are showing few to no symptoms, and those people have been asked to stay in self-isolation at home. They're not in hospital, although of course there are a significant number of course who are in hospital and some who are in intensive care, and as we have seen, the death toll here is getting higher.
And obviously they are taking these very serious measures to try to contain and deal with the virus. What sort of impact is all of this having on Italian society?
Big impact. People, you know, not only can children not go to school, students are sitting at home. That has implications certainly with children in terms of childcare. It's had a huge impact on tourism. And the outbreak also started in northern Italy, which is the real powerhouse of Italy. Economy. There are serious concerns about what this means and whether Italy may soon be facing recession.
That was Bethany Bell in Milan. So how are the Italian public feeling about the outbreak and the response to it? We asked Italians to send us audio messages on WhatsApp with their opinions.
My name is Lisa Camillo, based in Milan. The situation here in Milan and in Italy is actually not as bad as the media is portraying to be. People are still going out, taking public transport. We are still enjoying going out for drinks and dinners. Perhaps it's not as busy as it used to be. And unfortunately, it's actually affecting our economy. And that's why here in Italy, there is more... We're more worried about that, actually, than the actual virus.
There is Gabriele from Rome, Italy. Here in the Eternal City, we can see two different kind of people who thinks that is a pandemia, such as movie like World War Z or The Walking Dead, and who thinks that this virus is as dangerous as other winter virus. Unfortunately, the politicians talk purely and too much about some things that they don't understand. And in Rome, we have empty markets, empty streets. But in the center city, we see happy people that enjoy Rome, especially tourists, because Rome is magical, invincible.
Some voices from Italy. To the US now, where the former mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg, has abandoned his expensive bid for the White House. Instead, he's endorsed the former Vice President Joe Biden to be the Democratic candidate that challenges Donald Trump in November. Mr. Bloomberg failed to win big in 14 primary elections held on Tuesday, despite pumping $500 million of his own money into the campaign. At a rally in New York, Mr. Bloomberg told supporters that Mr. Biden had the best chance of winning the presidency.
I've known Joe for a very long time. I know his decency, his honesty, his commitment to the issues that are so important to our country, including gun safety, health care, climate change, and good jobs. He fought for working people his whole life. And I'm glad to say I endorse Joe Biden, and I hope you will join me in working to make him the next president of the United States of America.
Our North America correspondent Nada Taufik in New York told us more about his unconventional campaign.
Many thought of it almost as a political experiment. I mean, for one, Mr. Bloomberg just got into the race 3 months ago. So many people were asking if just waiting so long after all of the other candidates had been in so many debates, had built their ground game way ahead of him, would put him at a big disadvantage. It turns out, in fact, that when he did finally get to debate these last two times right before South Carolina's primary, that actually it hurt him. He had a really bad debate performance. The other part that made his candidacy really unique was the fact that he was self-funding. He was using billions of his own personal fortune, not relying on donations, small donations, or even big donors. And what that meant was he was able to put adverts out that made him look slick, made him look like a leader, really play up all of the attributes that made him a popular mayor in New York. But in the end, again, many people just looked back at his record, issues about stop and frisk policies in New York, where he profiled, New York City profiled young black men and stopped them, and also surveillancing Muslims. So all of these things came up, and many else people also questioned whether at this political moment what the Democrats needed was another white rich man to go up against Donald Trump.
Now, as you say, he has spent a lot of his own money. Is he going to keep spending on Mr. Biden?
He will. He has said he's going to keep spending money to help Democrats. He's going to keep his offices open. And he said in a statement he's going to do everything he can to help Joe Biden become president. I mean, in the past, he has said he would even be willing to spend up to $1 billion of his fortune. So he is not going away from the Democratic Party in that sense at all.
And what about Mr. Trump's reaction? He was fairly scathing, wasn't he?
Yeah, that's right. We know how President Trump often likes to troll a lot of these candidates on Twitter. He said, "Mini Mike just quit" in a tweet. He's like, "I could have told him a long time ago that he didn't have what it takes to be president, would have saved him money." And he's basically saying it's not going to help Joe Biden either, getting support from Michael Bloomberg. And just to note, Michael Bloomberg tweeted back with a Star Wars Darth Vader tweet saying he's coming soon, Trump.
That was Nada Taufik in New York. Now, we often cover global warming on this podcast, and you may remember that Antarctica recorded a record high temperature in February, over 20 degrees Celsius. And that's bad news for the extraordinary marine life that lives in the continent's icy waters. The BBC's environment correspondent Justin Rowlatt just returned from Antarctica, where he met some of the biologists leading the research into the impact the changing Antarctic environment is having.
A team of Antarctic ice divers load their equipment into a bright red snow truck and drive out onto the sea ice of McMurdo Sound. Few animals can survive the bitter cold here, but one Antarctic environment is actually surprisingly stable, the ocean. The divers get ready in an insulated hut above an ice hole. They've drilled down through 3 metres of ice to get to the water. Associate Professor Amy Moran is a biologist and an expert on Antarctic marine life.
The water here is extraordinarily cold. It's just about the coldest water on Earth. It's -2 degrees and it's very stable. So in the high Antarctic, which is where we are, the southernmost open ocean waters in the world, it's that temperature pretty much year-round. All right, here goes.
Because it has been so cold for so long, the animals here have evolved to survive in this uniquely harsh environment.
It's actually very difficult to function at freezing temperature of seawater because everything goes so slowly. So they've optimized their metabolisms for that temperature. And they have never seen anything warmer than that in millions of years. So they simply can't cope with it well.
But Antarctica, like the rest of the world, is changing. In some places, the sea here is already warming. It's also getting more acidic as carbon dioxide in the atmosphere dissolves into the water. These changes create unprecedented new challenges for the marine creatures here. So the question is whether these Antarctic animals can adapt. And that is something they're trying to find out back at the main US research station in Antarctica.
So some of the incredible Antarctic animals are in this tank. Anne Todgham, you're a marine biologist. You've been studying these animals for years.
Anne's tanks are packed with some of the weirdest creatures you could imagine. There are rubbery yellow pillows with forests of wavy fronds and giant scarlet sea spiders which totter in slow motion on preposterously long, spindly legs. There are luminous green snails which have no shells and look like scoops of lime jelly, and silver slugs with luminous white horns. Oh, and there are a couple of fish there too. But every single species has learned to cope in the super cold water here.
So, I mean, the animals look incredible, but what is so special about Antarctic species?
You take a fish, let's say from California, that's where I'm from, you put it in here, it would freeze instantly. And these, they're swimming around, they're really active. So they have antifreeze proteins inside of them that keep them from freezing. They have different red blood cells. They're, in fact, not red because they're missing some of these proteins. And they have compensated for the cold, so they can go about their daily lives and actually thrive in an environment that most animals would find very stressful.
The problem is they just don't seem to be very good at coping with change.
I'm actually pretty worried. I wish the data was wrong. I wish I didn't have to be worried. But, you know, there are lots of things that are going to change in the ocean. And these animals are being stressed to their max.
These animals live at the end of the world. If the sea here gets warmer, there really is nowhere for them to go.
Justin Rolat reporting from Antarctica. Now to a story dominating Brazilian social media for days now, whether a relationship on the latest series of Big Brother was emotionally abusive. The man involved, a contestant called Guilherme, was voted off the programme. Nuala McGovern asked Camila Mota from BBC Brazil to explain the furore.
There's this couple, Guilherme and Gabriela. They started a relationship on the first days of the TV shows. Things were doing great until he started flirting with another girl. He said there was no reason to worry, he was doing nothing wrong, that they only had a tight relationship, a tight friendship. But as time passed, his girlfriend started asking more and more questions, and he replied not aggressively, but always in a rude way. An episode that people commented a lot about on social media happened when she was crying a lot at one point, and he said to her in a very harsh way that she, quote, was hurting his image. So that sparked a big debate about abusing relationships and psychological violence here in Brazil.
So let's go a little bit further with that, the actual language. What were people saying specifically was the issue?
People were saying a lot that psychological abuse is way harder to identify than physical abuse. So that was important to see so women could sometime relate, women that were maybe going through something similar in their relationships. And it's really hard to identify when they being victims of psychological violence or things like that. So that was the thing that people were focusing on.
And how many people are talking about this? Is it something that everybody's aware of?
It's been on trending topics on Twitter, I think, for the past 2 or 3 days.
Mm.
And Big Brother in Brazil actually hit a record last night, 400 million votes to get him out of the house. But I think this topic specifically caught people's attention because we have a wider international discussion about sexism, with a feminist movement gaining momentum in a lot of countries, including Brazil. So I think that that has to do. If it happened 10 years ago, maybe the response wouldn't be the same.
Camila Mota from BBC Brazil. Still to come in this podcast.
Why not? We kind of enjoy it. You know, we enjoy each other's company. We enjoy playing together.
A blast from the past as an 80s rock favourite returns to the scene. now to the tense situation on Turkey's border with Greece. The EU has urged Turkey not to encourage the movement of migrants to the border, as officials there deny allegations that soldiers opened fire on migrants who were attempting to cross. There are reports that a number of people were killed and injured. From the border, our correspondent Jonah Fisher reports.
From the Turkish side of the river, we can see the Greek security forces watching us. This is the border of the European Union, and every night migrants are making fresh attempts to get across. Mustafa from Senegal is one of them, and he tells us that last night he reached Greece three times, and on each occasion was caught and sent straight back. On one of those occasions, he said things got out of hand, and two Syrians were shot by the Greeks. Are you sure they were killed? I ask him. They're dead. It was in front of me, he says, before gesturing that they were hit on the neck and forehead. Further north along the border, there was more violence. Turkey says a migrant was killed and several injured when Greek security forces opened fire. Greece has denied that and says they haven't killed anyone and that it's all Turkish propaganda. In a nearby town, we saw more evidence of how this large movement of people has been orchestrated by the Turkish authorities. In a central car park, there was a bright white bus full of people.
Where are you guys from? You're from Afghanistan? From Syria.
The occupants of the bus were being kept well fed by a Turkish charity, and the police were watching from nearby. The migrants are about to be taken to the water's edge and pointed towards a European Union that wants nothing to do with them.
That was Jonah Fisher at the border between Turkey and Greece. When Brazilian journalists gathered for their daily presidential briefing in Brasilia on Wednesday, they were surprised to be greeted not by President Jair Bolsonaro, but by a lookalike comedian he sent out in his stead. Our correspondent in Sao Paulo, Katie Watson, described a video of the appearance.
So in the video that was filmed by his entourage, you see this comedian getting out. He's dressed in a presidential sash and joking, really, with the people. There are both journalists there and there are supporters. But this surprised everybody, and it was the supporters who you could hear laughing in the background, taking photos. Certainly this has come as, yeah, a surprise, bit of a shock. I mean, this is something that we see, unfortunately, with Jair Bolsonaro. He give official press conferences. He gets the reporters to come to him, if you like, and wait outside every morning. So this was a joke, really, that he played on the reporters this morning.
But there are plenty of quite serious things to talk about, like coronavirus and the economy and so on. So why did he do this?
So the figures came out on the economy earlier, and the country is growing slower than was expected. And of course, he came to power promising much better economic figures. And of course, the coronavirus is expected to have impacted that. But he you know, used this as a way to avoid talking. The comedian, in fact, gave out bananas to the journalist. It's actually a very offensive gesture that he has done in the past, giving out bananas, avoiding really the conversation and showing his disrespect towards the journalist. But he certainly avoided talking about that is very serious, that has a lot of people worried, especially now that the coronavirus has arrived here in Brazil.
And just briefly, we did hear some laughter in that video, didn't we? What generally has the reaction been?
Well, I think people are... That laughter comes from his supporters who are there waiting for him every morning as well. But certainly a lot of people here have, you know, expressed disappointment that somebody at this level, the leader of a country, can joke around like that. But, I mean, does it come as a surprise? The fact is that his attitude, his response towards journalists is very well known. Yes, it might be disappointing. He doesn't want to talk to the press. He respects very few journalists. But, you know, yes, it came as a surprise and disappointment.
That was Katie Watson in Brazil. In Kenya, a once notorious mosque says it's turned itself around. Masjid Musa, in the tourist island of Mombasa, became synonymous with accusations of radicalization. One of its clerics, Sheikh Abud Rogo, had a reputation for being linked to Al-Shabaab and Al-Qaeda. Now the mosque has become a centre for reconciliation and peace building. The BBC's Ferdinand Omondi reports from Mombasa.
In 2014, tear gas filled the air as police raided the Masjid Musa Mosque in central Mombasa twice, Police said the mosque had been turned into a center for recruiting youths to join militant group Al-Shabaab. They impounded grenades, propaganda audio, video discs and black flags with painted rifles associated with Al-Shabaab. More than 100 people, mostly young men, were arrested. Masjid Musa became a crime scene and was shut down in November that year. This was an unprecedented move. Youth-led riots soon followed, forcing tenants to move out of nearby apartments. Community elders and regional leaders met to reform the mosque's leadership, expelling radical imams and replacing them with new, moderate ones. A few weeks later, the state handed the mosque back to the community after being satisfied with its reforms. Among the reforms was a delicate process to reintegrate the radicalized youth. The new man put in charge was Shabi Islam.
We did not use guns. We prayed and used kind words. Village and mosque elders engaged the entire community to convince the young people to change their ways. Today they have. No one can say they came back by the way of the gun. They changed due to prayer and engagement.
People no longer fear walking or living near the mosque as it was a few years ago, and tenants are flooding back into the neighborhood. But beneath this veneer of calm, there are still unanswered questions. In Mombasa's suburb of Changamwe, a middle-aged woman is piecing together a few tailoring orders from a small shop overlooking a busy back street. Sadaf Suleiman's husband was among the hundreds of people arrested at Masjid Musa during the anti-terror crackdowns. While many were later released, Sada's husband Hemed never came home. A judicial inquiry concluded that police may have killed him, but she wants a conclusive answer.
The government is supposed to tell us where he is, because they are the ones who took him. We saw them take him. So they need to at least tell us where he is. We have never been told that.
Police acknowledge arresting Hemed, but told the inquiry he jumped off a lorry and ran off while he was being taken to a police station and that officers could not catch up with him. He was in handcuffs.
The BBC's Ferdinand Omondi reporting from Mombasa. In Hong Kong, the High Court has ruled that same-sex couples can now apply for public housing. That's despite the fact that same-sex marriage and civil unions are not currently recognised in the territory. Our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Michael Bristow, told Jonathan Savage about the case.
This couple, they were married in 2018 in Canada, but they're permanent residents in Hong Kong. They're low income, and they felt they met the standard to apply for social housing in Hong Kong. It's very expensive, so they applied for social housing. They were turned down because of that definition. Furthermore, the housing agency said that already were oversubscribed, and so we're not going to extend our definition of what is a family to include same-sex couples. The judge in his ruling said that was ridiculous, that same-sex couples had no lesser need for housing than couples between opposite-sex partners. This had been welcomed by the couple involved, and the Hong Kong government has said it's going to look at this ruling before making a decision about changing the rules.
So what do people in Hong Kong in general think about this ruling?
Well, it comes at a kind of quite an interesting time about and a debate about same-sex couples in Hong Kong. Late last year, the court ruled, agreed with the government that same-sex couples should remain illegal. So it's not yet legal in Hong Kong, but at the same time, over the last couple of years, we've had a number of individuals themselves taking legal action against the government on very specific, narrow issues, such as this one. There was one previously where a gay couple argued that they had the right to a visa, the partner had a right to a visa to remain in Hong Kong. Those cases have been won, but yet the overall legal case are same-sex couples legal. That's been lost. So it's quite a confused situation at the moment and a lot of debate about it in Hong Kong.
That was Michael Bristow.
It's been 13 years since the rock band Genesis performed, and now they're coming out of retirement, ready to turn it on again. They became one of the world's most successful rock bands of the 1980s and have sold more than 100 million records worldwide. Here's our entertainment correspondent, Colin Patterson.
Genesis. The arena tours, the shiny suits, the drum duets. During their 80s and early 90s pomp, they had five consecutive UK number one albums. Now that lineup of Phil Collins, Mike Rutherford and Tony Banks has reunited to tour again. Phil Collins' explanation is simple.
It sounds a bit of a lame reason just to say why not, but we kind of enjoy it. You know, we enjoy each other's company, we enjoy playing together. Why not?
Before their 80s slickness, their sound was prog. Many fans hoped Genesis would one day reform their 1971-75 lineup, with Peter Gabriel and Steve Hackett included. But Tony Banks says that wasn't even discussed.
Peter left almost 50 years ago now. We love Peter and everything, but it's just the most of the music we do is since then, and that's kind of what we're playing, really.
There is one addition this time. A decade ago, a neck injury left Phil Collins unable to drum, so those duties are to be filled by his 18-year-old son, Nick, although he's not ruled out a return.
I'm going to try my best. You know, there's some basic stuff that I can do, which I hope to be able to do. Because the sound of two drummers, there's no getting around the fact that it does sound powerful and impressive.
Colin Patterson on the reunion of Genesis. And that's all from us for now, but I'd better go before I'm in too deep. But let there be no misunderstanding. There will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. I'm sorry, I'll stop there. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, do please send us an email. The address remains globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.
Brought to you by Capital One, where you can open a savings account in about 5 minutes and earn five times the national average. Just imagine, five times more savings toward that overdue home addition, maybe even an addition on that addition. This is banking reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A. member FDIC.